Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant! Gee! He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Does it tame and tame and tame again?
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
Doorstepping with Jonathan Pearce. How to respectfully report an own goal. The Three Lions are an abstract concept. Playing for England does not make you a Three Lion. Can a win be pivotal until something ultimately pivots on it? Someone breaks a previously unexplained law of talking about opening goals. The Factory of Sadness. Onomatopoeic references to referees' whistles in live blogs. Which name should come first in a strike partnership? And the footballing stars begin to align for Richard Keys. Brought to your ears by Goalhanger Podcasts. This is Football Clichés. Hello everyone and welcome to Football Clichés. I'm Adam Hurry. I'm on the banks of the Mississippi right now, and not quite with me are Charlie Eccleshare. How you doing?
Very well.
And David Walker, how are things?
Yeah, things are good.
Excellent. I'm on holiday, so I've not really been across the football. It's a very strange feeling, Charlie, when football carries on without you when you're on holiday. It seems to me that more mad stuff seems to happen when you're not quite in touch with football, when you've got that bit of distance. More mad games seem to happen, and football runs away from you, and it's annoying. I don't like it.
Yeah, you don't have control. Things are all happening too quickly, and then you're catching up, and it's tricky. It is weird.
Yeah. Obviously, we're decades beyond the having to get the newspapers from yesterday era, but it does feel still like the remnants of that, the echoes of that age. Anyway, Davey, I'm thankful in these particular moments that we're not a topical football discussion pod, I don't know, called All Things Football, for example, where we would start with whether that dramatic FA Cup quarterfinal win over Liverpool might just be the moment that kickstarts Erik ten Hag's Manchester United reign.
Or that saved the FA Cup. Let's go bigger.
Look, what a moment it was.
There's life in this grand old competition yet.
You try telling those 70,000 fans at Old Trafford that the FA Cup doesn't matter. Could do this for an hour. Would be delighted, but no. Right, adjudication panel time. This first one came from literally everybody, including accidental Partridge. It's Jonathan Pearce, Chelsea versus Leicester.
You would normally say they have 1 foot in the semi-final, but for Chelsea, it's like 1 foot on a doormat, on a slippery tile floor that's already coated with water. You never know with them.
This is great, Charlie, but it's also, I would suggest that of all the kind of vague footballing phrases out there, this is probably the one that's most ripe for corruption like that, because there are so many in between. I think we might have touched on this before.
We have,
like,
yeah.
So I think Pearce has done it justice there, I think.
Yeah, shades a little bit of the cake to be so palatable. Also involving Chelsea. So yeah. Rich as to be extremely palatable. Yeah, no, it definitely does. I think we have talked about that, the threshold for 1 foot or whatever it is, both within an individual game and at the end of a first leg.
Dave, I feel like not many commentators could have pulled off this extended analogy. Do you think it works?
I was trying to think whether... Would the bit underneath the mat, would you have lifted the mat and made the bit under the mat wet? Would you actually slip on the mat in that scenario? I don't think the bit underneath the mat would be wet, so I think you'd be fine.
You'd be insulated.
Poor old Jonathan Pearce halfway through his analogy going, I bet there's a literally Dave out there who's going to tear this apart. Well, you've got to do it when you've got to do it on the hoof. These things happen. Elsewhere at Stamford Bridge, just after Axel Disasi produced one of the most memorable own goals in recent times, a fine entry to the genre of deadpan
team have just conceded tweets, Charlie. Chelsea tweeted, the visitors pull a goal back. listener Dave said, going to need a check on this one. Well, I mean, it's an interesting point. First of all, can you justify using the phrase visitors pull a goal back if you've scored an own goal? I mean, is that still a catch-all for you?
Yeah, it's definitely one of those that's said unthinkingly, because normally it would be fine in like 90-odd% of instances. It feels a bit weird. Like, it is technically okay, but they have, given that they haven't technically scored the goal themselves,
wasn't really their endeavor, was it? But my second question then, Dave, is bearing in mind the context in which this is happening, this is Chelsea basically just getting the information out and moving on very quickly, as all tweets like this have to be. There's no real alternative, is there? Because the moment you address the own goal as a thing that happened, you're basically slating one of your own players, and as we know, that's just not the done thing. So there's no alternative here, is there? I don't know. A goal has happened. That's, what else can they say?
The visitors are back in it, could you say? Or is that providing too much kind of narratival commentary?
It's sort of encouraging them, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't be like, game on at Stamford Bridge.
Goal for Leicester.
The visitors have, and even then if they have scored, they haven't quite scored, so yeah.
Yeah, how prosaic can you be?
That would have got more ridicule if they'd just said goal for Leicester, I think. That would have got more quote tweets, I think, than the original.
The deficit has been halved.
Mm, yes.
Use the passive and purely factual.
I mean, if all we get out of this is Charlie using the word narratival on the Football Cliches podcast for the first time, then we win, frankly. Game on. Related to that, Matt Ginsberg gets in touch, Dave, and says, a random question, but if you score your own goal, do you score an own goal for the opposition club, or do you score an own goal for your own club? For example, did Richard Dunn score own goals for Manchester City or for the opposition? I mean, it's not a crucial bit of phrasing. I don't think it's ever going to change the course of history, but I do wonder that we may probably slip into he scored an own goal for Chelsea, Dizazi, for example. Doesn't work.
You'll often see, if a team's having a particularly bad season in front of goal, strikers aren't scoring many or whatever, there'll be the odd meme stat will go around, say like, own goal is Manchester United's second top scorer this season. But it wouldn't be listed as the individual players who'd scored the own goals.
That's a very good point.
We'd have Richard Dunn as the fourth top goal scorer for a team if he scored a few own goals against them.
Bringing this into our universe, I'd say this is one of the FAQs on Happy Hunting Grounds. People frequently asking, what do you do about own goals? Does that count as a goal for the team? And the answer is yes, it does. It's still, it still counts.
We sort of skirted around this issue a few weeks ago, didn't we? When we had the clip from, I think it was from TalkSport, and it was heads Tottenham behind or whatever.
Yeah, the Wolves game, yeah.
Yeah.
That wasn't even an own goal. That was just, rather than saying he heads Wolves in front, is he heads Spurs behind, yeah.
And I think we flipped it, to say that what about if it was an own goal? And it's kind of that same sort of territory, isn't it, really? You're doing something for the other team whilst wearing your own team's shirt. It is kind of a bit of both.
Yeah, it is a bit of both. I think we're just so entangled in a goal being scored for a team that we just can't rip ourselves away from it when an own goal scored. I don't think there's an elegant alternative, unfortunately.
Well, it's weird, isn't it? Because like, obviously goals count, own goals count just as much for the team that you're scoring them for, but they don't count as a shot on target, which is again also always used as like a fun bit of stats play. I remember so vividly the first time being across this when Arsenal lost 3-0 to Middlesbrough in April 2001, it must have been, to hand United the title. And it was, I remember hearing on the radio, and Middlesbrough won 3-0 and had one shot on target, and it kind of blowing my mind. I was like, what? They've had one shot on target? How's that happened?
It's very impactful. First time I'd ever used that information. Yeah, I agree with you.
To kind of take this to sort of furthest kind of most absurd point, if you did consider that own goals were like really scoring for the other team, then surprising the whole history of football, we've never had a team mob an opposing player who's just scored an own goal for them.
We've come close. There's been ridicule, and there's been sort of fingers wagged in faces. I think John Aldridge against Fernando Couto might be worth looking up in this result. A very brave thing to do is what I would say. But not a full mobbing, but definitely had some acknowledgement of an own goal scorer. Elsewhere at Stamford Bridge, a minute detail, but it's certainly got my back up. This came from Scott Charlie. It says, the additional time in Chelsea versus Leicester was announced with the green numbers on the fourth official's board rather than the red numbers. Something about that feels inherently wrong. Shouldn't extra numbers always be red? Is there no law about this? I actually don't know. Is it red or green? Green? Red?
No, it is red.
Red. It's surely red.
Yeah, it is red.
What are the green numbers used for? Oncoming players?
I think so.
Okay.
This begs the question as well. Is there a hitherto unseen amber colour that just is there. We need it. It's just never been used. Like Thunderbird 4.
For sin bins, maybe. This is pertinent to, from the live shows, me suggesting I could do the role of a fourth official. There's an added layer of complication here that I wasn't aware of. If even some of the pros are struggling with it.
If you put the additional time in green, Dave, does that mean he gets taken off? I don't know. He's going to get marked down by the assessor anyway. Let's put it that way. Green numbers.
Are some boards just green? How many times collectively have we been at matches or watched matches and seen the boards go up? And this question, you're just like, I'm sure it's always red. When do the green numbers get used? Are some boards fully green?
PGMOL be apologising for this.
I think green are players coming on.
Okay.
But that may not be right.
Once Keezy hears about this as well. Finally, at Stamford Bridge, on the BBC's coverage, this is Martin Keown weighing up the benefits of Leicester not conceding a penalty versus having a player sent off for denying a goal-scoring opportunity.
This goes in now as a Leicester player. I'd rather have had a full quartet of players on the pitch, 11. Maybe best chance of getting back at it. So let's, from a Leicester point of view, you're hoping this doesn't go in.
Now, the usual caveat here, David, that we don't like taking the mick out of people who might have misspoken. But one, I'm just amused by the fact that he possibly thinks that quartet is 11 players. But also, I also can't think of what word he might have been going for. So I'm highly amused.
Full quota?
Quota.
Or compliment.
I thought that was just so far removed from quartet. So now I'm really baffled.
Oh, I don't know. Or a combination of the two.
Full quartet sort of. Is it an analogy of, you know, like a string quartet, like the full, you've got the full lineup?
I really, 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 really want it to be the case that Martin Keown thinks quartet just means the full amount of people in something. I want it to be true more than anything in my life.
I mean, of all people to have string quartet as a reference point, I wouldn't totally rule it out with Martin Keown. It is possible. If still extremely unlikely that's what he was going for there.
Moving on, love a good crowd sound on this, although I feel like it makes us look like we never go to football games in our entire lives. But still, this was sent by quite a few people. This is Mansfield Town's second goal against Bradford City at the weekend. We've heard crowd noises as players shoot before, but nothing quite like this. So crisp. Dave, the yeah-ohs, just so well-formed there. What a roller coaster.
That's a nice variation on the usual examples of this, our go-ons, which we've featured some really good ones of those in the past. But the yeah-oh, you can probably tell from the audio, but it's a goal-mouth scramble. The defender blocks it on the line, then the goalkeeper makes it a really sort of last-ditch save before they eventually score. But it does look like they're going to score every time they shoot. The goal is gaping with every chance. So, yeah, it's a really nice rhythm. And it's very consistent as well. Doesn't really change from shot to shot. The sound is exactly the same.
Charlie, this may well make me look even more naive when it comes to noises that happen at football matches, but it really rams home the fact that we shout yeah when a goal goes in. Like, so I think it's something we take for granted, but that one, it really is very signposted, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, as a way of saying yeah, would have sounded odd. Yes, very much so.
That is an interesting point, Adam, because why do we say yeah? I actually say yeah quite a lot, I think, in general sort of usage.
You sometimes write it Y-E-A, which I hate, I have to say.
It's just a
despise
thing.
It makes my skin crawl.
But imagine if we were like, yes, oh, yes. It's not the same, is it? Yes.
Do they shout C in Spain?
C, oh.
I don't know. I feel it's more of a vamos or, you know, the kind of...
Yeah.
The come on or the LA, that sort of thing. Yeah, it does feel quite unique to us.
I have to say, I mean, much like Dave, Charlie, I do enjoy a yes when something very minor in my life goes the way I need it to. You know, even if it's just mere logistics, I'm like, yes. It's very satisfying to do. So, I might start using yes as a goal celebration rather than yeah.
Off the back of this, on the subject of go-ons, when I saw the saw that United had got that last minute winner in the game against Liverpool, and it was on a counter-attack and it was a ball played through from one player to another at the last minute. I was looking at the clip and thinking, oh, there's got to be Old Trafford, like last minute, it's got to be a great, great go-on. And there wasn't one. The Old Trafford crowd did not give us a go-on. certainly not a really audible one at the moment when Garnacho passes to Diallo. There wasn't one, and I was really disappointed.
Yeah, there's potential for at least two go-ons.
Yeah, it lends itself quite well to it.
Yeah, given that the ball was presented to them quite unexpectedly, that's the first go-on. If anything, you could have had three go-ons. The gaining of possession, the moving of the ball upfield where the opportunity begins to emerge, and then, of course, the final opportunity. Very disappointing. Should be chucked out the FA Cup again. Let's go back to last week, actually. This came from Kjetil Dvirznes. When Sparta Prague scored against Liverpool to make it 4-1 and 9-2 on aggregate in the 42nd minute, Bimancevic ran and collected the ball to restart the game. Surely that can't be allowed. You're not coming back from that lead ever. Can we get a ruling on this? This is a fascinating test for the grabbing the ball out of the net acceptability test, Charlie, because you have to factor in the aggregate. In the game itself, probably okay. You've got a whole half and a little bit more to go. But should you factor in aggregate as well?
No, I think it's acceptable, a game within itself, because pride. If they were to get a draw at Anfield, that in and of itself would be significant enough to justify this kind of behaviour. You know, that would be a famous comeback for them, even if they were still battered on aggregate. If, you know, remember the time we were 4-0 down and we drew 4-4 at Anfield. But if it was just 9-2 in the game, then I think you do look ludicrous.
Absolutely. I'm comforted in a way that you know, professional footballers' standards are such that they focus just on that leg and how that leg will make them feel, as opposed to the overall aggregate. Good for him. You never knew what might happen after that. This has happened before, once before, and it's happened again. Keep your ear out for this. This came from James McGrath. This is England C international Callum Maycock scoring for Solihull Moors against Boreham Wood in the National League. Listen to what the commentator says about him.
The first time we've really seen that this evening. Shade across the box. Into the box! Into the back of the net! And it's Solihull's 3-Lion! And it's Callum Maycock with the finish.
Now, Charlie, this isn't me being snobby about England C. I love England C as a concept. It's the fact that some people believe that an individual England international should be called a 3-Lion. I can't believe this has happened. This might well be spreading.
Did you say you'd heard that before?
Yeah, it popped up, I think, during the Women's Euros or maybe the Women's World Cup.
There isn't really an elegant way to do it because, I mean, Lioness is much more suited to it. It feels much smoother and it just kind of works a bit better. Whereas Solihull's Lion...
They're just not known as the Lions, are they, in any way? The 3 Lions is this kind of abstract concept of England and it's the badge, obviously. It should never be attached to an individual player. And then when it does, look at the end result. It's chaos. It's awful. 3 Lion. What does it mean? What does he think it means? Oh, dear. You can see how it's happened, but I am so concerned that this is going to become the thing. I'm really concerned, especially with the Euros looming at the end of the season. And tournaments do loom, by the way. But how far away can a tournament loom, Charlie? I think once you get to the business end of the domestic season, then a tournament begins to loom because injuries could affect it. You know, players might have their mind on it and down tools. So I think the Euros is looming.
So a kind of player X injures hamstring with Euros looming?
Yeah.
Sort of thing. I mean, I definitely think post this international break that we're in, once players are back and we're into, you know, the clocks have changed and there's not another international break, and we're basically in April, then definitely. There could have been, even this weekend, there might have been.
Well, I think this weekend, the fact that had this squad announcement for this international break last week, that immediately makes people focus on the prospect of the Euros. I've had some chats with people, or, you know, the early clamour chats about this player should go, that player shouldn't go. Sterling having a bad game yesterday kind of makes people focus on how far he's fallen.
You're having some earnest little England squad chats, are you?
I've had it well. Let's just say I've been in some WhatsApp groups where squads, where full 24s have been...
Whispering quietly,
about.
But excellent.
Chelsea's 3 Lion, Raheem Sterling.
That's it. You have to retire from that sort of chat now. You're part of the Football Clichés podcast. Right, over to Friday night, where Chelsea comprehensively swept aside Arsenal in the WSL at Stamford Bridge. And the Sky Sports WSL official account tweeted, a pivotal win for Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. Now, Dave, I don't think you can declare a win as pivotal unless it turns out to be so at the end of the season. It can only be retrospectively labelled as such, right? I'll give you context of the league table. Chelsea, when the dust had settled on this WSL, WSL weekend. Chelsea are level on points at the top with Manchester City and top on goal difference. 6 points clear of Arsenal as a consequence of that win. So I can see where they were going. But can you call a win pivotal if the thing that pivots on it isn't even close to happening yet?
No, exactly. I think you can speculate that could be a pivotal win.
I was going to say it could prove, or then in the midst of time in the future, you can say it proved to be. It's always those. Even though pivotal does just mean crucial, I mean, it is, it's technically fine. But yeah, within the footballing parlance, it has come to mean more like decisive, I think. In the same way, you couldn't say a decisive win for Chelsea in the title race at this point.
Yes.
We don't know.
But even mid-game, Charlie, I don't know, let's say, I'd say a goal that brought it back to 2-2 in the middle of a game and with half an hour left and that team were in the ascendancy and the commentator might call that goal, oh, it's a pivotal goal. It kind of works mid-game because you're very much in the moment.
Momentum has shifted.
And you can feel the game pivoting, but I don't know. Pivotal to me has to be retrospective. I've confused myself, but you couldn't say it mid-game either, could you, Charlie?
No, I'm not sure you could. Yeah, I think it's the same thing. I think you'd still say, and that could prove to be a pivotal moment in this game and in this and in the title race or something. I think declaring it, you'd be wary of declaring it with so much left to go, even in it within just a game.
Exactly.
You'd think you could use it in a game, and I think it probably has been used in a game, I'm sure, many times. It's more about the feeling, because you're there, you're in the moment. If it feels like a huge moment and momentum has shifted and one team is like now on the floor and the other team is on the up, like that's the pivot. The pivot is the momentum shifting, maybe, as opposed to the result of the game. Whereas in the context of the season, you're right. I think it has to be qualified with a could be a pivot, Chelsea with what could be a pivotal 3 points, or as you say, looking back retrospectively once the season's ended. That win against Manchester City at the Bridge, I mean, that did turn out to be the pivotal moment.
On a related note, Charlie, I was tweeted the other day by Jack Pinder, who says the phrase, the pendulum swings again. Does a pendulum ever stop swinging? it's not an event, is it? The pendulum always swinging. Mundane, if anything. But yeah, good observation. Always a lovely little thing for us to visit. It's the ITV EFL highlights. This came from Ethan Henson, Stoke versus Norwich. And this is the commentator as Norwich streak away on the counter-attack for their opening goal.
Stoke have started well here. See what Norwich can do about that. Well, they're away here. Surely it's going to be a first. That defending from Stoke is poor. Will it be one? It is. It's Sargent with it.
Charlie, I can just about excuse the first, but will it be one? I've never heard.
No.
I've never heard it before in my life.
No. That's really weird. Or even, will it be the opener? It is, sort of thing. I could just about hear it. Just about imagine. I mean, because obviously, could it be four? Or could it be five? Mm. You know, you can imagine that. You've heard that.
Or makes it two.
Yeah. But will it be one?
Why not one? Dave, why not one? What do the other numbers have in this very specific context that one doesn't deliver? If anything, one's more important. It's the first goal of the game. Potentially pivotal.
You're right, but absolutely, the only place you hear it, like Charlie said, is, could it be five when it's something so...
That's incredulous.
Remarkable.
Yeah, it's surprise. Yeah. It's like, this is amazing. Whereas a team going 1-0 up after 18 minutes or whatever that was.
But why couldn't it be goal scorer made it one? It should be five, shouldn't it? But it sounds awful, and that's the main thing. Made
I think
it
because
one.
It's like made it two or made it three, as if there's been like an addition process.
Yeah. It's transformed into like, two or three. Yeah, okay.
Just made it one.
No, a very astute observation from you. Well done. Yes.
Doesn't work.
The first goal is just, it has its own built-in context, doesn't it, Charlie? It's the opener. It's the first goal of the game. There's too much other stuff you can say first for making it one. Wow. Will it be one? Can't believe it.
Could it be one? It is.
ITV EFL highlights are esoteric in many ways, but I can't believe this came to mind for him. It was an instinctive thing to say. It's not in the commentator's textbook.
Maybe it's his trademark. We need to keep our eye out.
Maybe.
For other instances of this.
Yeah. Much more lawless area of football discourse, Charlie, is the BBC Sport live blog that ticks along on a match day. And Wizards of Drivel, the Stoke City podcast, sent us this. 16:43 on Saturday, Stoke 0, Norwich 3. The Bet365 Stadium is a factory of sadness right now. What an incredible variation on Theatre of Dreams that is. Factory of sadness.
it's a weird turn of phrase because factory, it suggests that they're kind of making sadness there.
Yeah, generating
sadness.
Which
I suppose they are. I mean, you like talent factory is a kind of approved usage of factory in football, isn't it? But yeah, factory of sadness, that is quite odd.
Really jarring phrase, Dave, but it also has a That's quite effective. There's a impact there, Factory of Sadness.
Yeah, I quite like it.
Can you imagine like a beleaguered Stoke fan saying, I've got to go, haven't I? I'm down to the Factory of Sadness today. Hope it catches on.
Put another shift in down the factory.
Right. A very subtle but enjoyable example here, Charlie, of peripheral football speak working its way into other areas. This is an Instagram advert for the 10% Club, which is some sort of supplement. And Matty Cash has provided a testimonial for this. And Matt Skingle sent it in. And Matty Cash's testimonial reads, 30 days of taking Cardio Plus and unwind and sleep. I feel amazing. And my sleep is flying. Matt Skingle says, surely not the desired effect of this Instagram advertised supplement. You don't want your sleep to be flying. Again, it's a bit like making it one. It's just a baffling thing to say.
My sleep's on fire at the moment.
Yeah.
Such a good sleep last night. I was just buzzing all night long.
So I'm sleeping for fun.
In a good moment, sleep-wise. That is an extraordinary thing to say. I mean, this is more though, footballers using football language in everything. My sleep is flying.
Really tremendous.
So good.
Okay, that brings us to the end of part one of the adjudication panel. We'll be back very shortly. Welcome back to the adjudication panel. Let's kick off with this. I adored this. It came from Aaron Tyndall. He says, half an hour into Soccer Saturday, Darren Bent announced that Ipswich had a corner in a dangerous position, which was presumably from one of four places. There's a follow-up here, Charlie. But first of all, does this even qualify as you kind of know what he means? I don't. It's right on the outskirts of you know what he means.
I guess the only way you know what you mean is a corner can feel more dangerous at different times. If there have been a few and they've had a few that have like caused mayhem in the opposition box and one team is known to be good at corners and or the other's known to be bad. You wouldn't say dangerous position, but you might say like they've got a corner and does feel like a goal from a corner has been coming this half.
You could feel the buzz in the crowd. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
What about if you had a very notable one-footed set piece specialist on your team and it was on their side to make it an in-swinger or an out-swinger?
And they kept having them on the other side. So it was like, all right, fine. This is a seventh corner, but this one, this is...
Okay, so an incredibly context-heavy relative usage of the term dangerous position. Or Dave, maybe it was where he placed it in the quadrant. Because you know quadrant...
Right on the edge, yeah.
Abuse is rife these days. So that might be a dangerous position. Relatively speaking, it's better than putting it deep next to the corner flag, which would make it a safe position. Anyway, regardless of this, Aaron Tyndall says, presumably this was one of four places, but Stephen Naive stuck his oar in and said, I'd argue it's one of two positions because, you know, attacking-wise, you're only going to get two places you can take a corner from. So bang on.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Love it. Corner in a dangerous position. Anyway, next up, Adam Foxcroft writes in, Charlie, and says, Alan Smith on Sky, while describing a Son Heung-min goal-scoring opportunity on Saturday, said, what a good chance by his standards. Can you please confirm there isn't a world where different players have different standard of goal-scoring chances? This is quite a common thing, Charlie. You probably hear it more for a goalkeeper of his quality or something like that. That kind of sliding scale of a scenario being more effective for certain players. And you do hear this a lot for players, but I'm interested to know which particular specific scenarios, goal scoring wise, become chances for a player of a certain standard. I wouldn't say like a half chance becomes a chance for a player of Son Heung-min's quality. What chance is most translatable?
Well, first of all, Alan Smith is quite astute here when he says this, because Son Heung-min is famously one of the best for outscoring XG. So he is a far better finisher than pretty much anyone. So works for anyone, it would work for Son. I think it would be a chance, maybe by his standards, one that's obviously it's not like a clear one-on-one. It might be one where the ball's come to him quickly, but for a player of his standards, so he doesn't have much time to react, but normally they're so good at doing it. Or it might be one from kind of the edge of the box that's not like easy, but he's so good that you would just sort of back him to find a corner.
I think edge of the box is a good shout. Maybe a slight angle.
It's a range-based thing in your eyes, is it?
Potentially, yeah. It's still... I just think it's conceivable. You know, we've seen players like Son score those chances. I don't know, like a prime Fernando Torres at Liverpool or something. You know, players that are capable of kind of just turning moments. They're not even half chances. They're sort of capable almost of scoring from nothing in a way.
I was just interested in the tipping point for this. I wanted to know what the specific scenario was.
What do you think it would be in your head?
Well, I mean, I like Charlie's idea that it was like technically a difficult chance to get under their spell before shooting, which would definitely be a separator from a good player to a great player, definitely. And that's still a chance, isn't it? Well, before you gather the ball, that is still technically a chance before you have a shot. So I think that works. Range, I'm all right with. I was thinking angle, personally. Having no right to score from there, that kind of thing. A slight variation on that, perhaps. But yeah, all sorts of things. But Son Heung-min, great to bring XG into the conversation and really use it as a proving tool there. I love that. That's not a phrase. Right, next up, David Green. It says, is there a right way and or time to correct wrong footballing statements when on the periphery of a conversation? I just heard a train guard say to another, great to see Kane doing well. They're top of the Bundesliga and in the Champions League quarterfinals. I felt I should correct him, but bottled it. I mean, Charlie, unequivocally, you cannot step in at this point for two reasons. One, you're not even remotely involved in the conversation, and two, it's not enough of an egregious mistake given the other stuff that goes around it, which you can't disagree with. That the Bundesliga thing, you got to let it slide, haven't you?
I can relate to this so much, and I'm trying to remember what it was. There was one recently I heard and I was like, no, don't get involved, don't worry about it.
The amount of opportunities you must have had in your life, yeah. Actually,
oh my god,
actually I think you find that goal
2011-12.
Yes, and sometimes I
no, they've moved from Highbury by then.
Talked about it in Fever Pitch, that thing of like someone getting something wrong and you are just like, it doesn't matter. They don't know or care that it's wrong. They're never going to sort of remember this anyway. And there is just this impulse to do it. Obviously, that's slightly different. That's in conversations you're having, which is another thing, because there are times where you're like, is it worth me correcting them? Is it not?
The only way to do it, Charlie, is to kind of drop the correction into your next passage of conversation. Yeah, no, they're second, actually. They are the donor. I mean, they're second. Now, Leverkusen obviously flying at the moment, so you're really trying to pad it out. And then you're looking for their face and going, oh no, sorry. That's fine.
That is a bit passive aggressive, but yeah, I'm a big fan of that. Like, yeah, no, of course, because they're second, obviously. But
yeah.
Related to this, the night I met my wife, we were chatting or whatever, and I was, you know, trying to impress her.
She was a train guard, and I just stepped
she was
in.
Working on the train, talking about the Bundesliga, but not a football thing. But we were both interrailing, and she was saying how she was listening to places she'd been, and she said, oh yeah, and then we went to Belgrave, obviously meaning Belgrade, and I was like, this is a really hard one. Every part of me wants to correct you, but there's just not enough upside. I'm going to have to let it slide. And that's when I knew that she was the girl for me.
Wow. She passed
that
test.
I didn't jump in. I was like, oh, the fact that I'm not being a pedant here, that speaks volumes. But God, did I want to. Belgrave.
Yeah, I've still married someone that thinks it's Belgrave, though, which is, fair play to you. Fair play to you.
As soon as I felt comfortable enough with her, I was like, by the way, just want to go back to something you said a few weeks ago.
It's done deal now. No, you can't get out of it. No, excellent. Well, we look like awful people now again. Right, Arnie Johnson. Again, this is Dave from sort of Match Day live blogs, general live blogs. And you often hear... Sorry, you often see at the start of a half, the live blogger will use peep to indicate that the half has started. That's the peep of a whistle. Arnie Johnson sent us this from the Sky Sports live blog, which I think was from the Man City game. And they went for beep, beep.
Is that him starting his watch for the...
Maybe.
You're really technical.
Referee R2-D2 taking control today at the Etihad.
No, I'd say moments like this, I'm very grateful for Charlie Eccleshare's brain, because you are... I'm not saying that is it, but that is a good justification for using beep. And if you were to be presented with it in court, I think you'd get away with it. Yeah, it's the beep of a stopwatch. Fair play. I mean, the stopwatch is just as important as a whistle when it comes to... keeping track of these things. So, all right, fine. Sky Sports, you're off the hook. Now, next, Jobby Mack writes in, Dave, and says, BBC Scotland said the St Johnstone goal was leading a charmed life only 30 minutes in. I know Celtic had already had a lot of chances, but surely it's too early in the game. I disagree. It's nothing to do with the stage of the game. It's to do with the peppering. It's to do with the sustained, concerted spell of pressure, no matter when it happens in the game. So you can lead a goal can lead a charmed life almost straight away, as long as it's had, say, three or four shots. And from then on, can happen anytime.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think there was a great example of this earlier in the season in the FA Cup with the Ipswich against Maidstone. game, where obviously Maidstone went on to win famously, but Ipswich were peppering their goal early on. They had so many chances in the first sort of 15, 20 minutes of that game. They hit the post, hit the bar, the keeper was making loads of saves, the ball was pinging around their box, and it was classic Charmed Life territory. So yeah, you're right, it's about volume of shots, and also not just volume of shots, but also like how close they are to going in, how sort of desperate you are.
How fortunate it feels that they haven't.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's got to be on target, Charlie. I mean, let's not beat around the bush here. Shots that whistle past posts, does that count as Charmed Life?
Woodwork, though, isn't technically on target, but if you keep hitting a team's woodwork, I think that's very Charmed Life.
Not on its own, but it can form part of it. There needs to be a certain, the majority of the shots need to be close to going in by either by a woodwork or a save or a block. But you can have the odd near miss in there. It still counts as the whole, I think.
Yeah, I concede defeat there. I am yet, in my fifth decade, I am yet to wean myself off considering shots that hit woodwork as on target. And loads of people feel the same. I think it's 50% of the population feel the same.
Another thing I remember first finding that out, like I was saying before, with shots on target not counting for own goals. I remember the first time I saw that, I was like, what? That feels crazy.
In spirit, it is. It's fine. Right.
More in many ways.
A clarion call, I think we can call this, from the Claritin Blue Pod, an Aston Villa podcast, who had this discussion and asked for our assistance.
The pundits and the commentary team were saying that it's points dropped for Villa. In the race for top four, Spurs now only 3 points behind them. It's drop points for Villa and opportunity missed. I agree with, because obviously Spurs lost yesterday, so if we'd have won today, we'd have opened up a bigger gap to fifth place, and that is a missed opportunity in that sense. But Spurs lost yesterday, we drew coming from behind, we held on at the end with a goal ruled out. That's a point gained.
You know, this term deserves to be submitted into football cliches to find out the true answer as to what it means. Because, I couldn't tell you neither there which way around it should be. To me, it is a point gain.
Now, Charlie, this is interesting. Well, it really depends on what kind of context you want to go with, really. I am won over by the fact that Aston Villa rescued the point in that individual game. But you could still argue, almost regardless of Spurs' result in the race for top four, that it was points dropped. I mean, I know it technically is, but they probably were expected to win that. They're having a good season. I know they're not in tremendous form in this medium term. Where do you stand on this for Aston Villa?
Isn't the classic response to this the sort of like, well, I guess we'll find out come what may sort of thing? Like, you don't... It's not immediately clear.
But it's not a bit of both. It's not a bit of both.
I don't think it can be a bit of both. I think this is too binary, even for the all-reaching powers of bit of both. I mean,
bit of both brigade.
The full context, Villa, that point gained or 2 points dropped, whatever you see it, that means Villa are 3 points ahead of Spurs, but Spurs have a game in hand, and goal difference the Spurs have is only one below, and their goal scored is only one below. So it could mean, actually, if Spurs win 1-0 in their game in hand, they'd be level on everything.
That's what you want.
So it's a very borderline case. And, you know, they were playing West Ham away. West Ham are seventh. It's not like they've gone away to Sheffield United or someone right at the bottom.
Exactly. It's not yet. Yeah, they're not home to a struggling side.
No, fair
but
enough.
I'm sorry to the Claret and Blue boys, but it does smack of a supporters desperately trying to find the positives in a situation where they can feel that it's not really going their way. I think that's a point gained, actually, really. At the end of the day, if you think about it, I think that's a point gained.
That said, I do think we sometimes, me especially, more than anyone, I mean, like, draws are incredibly frustrating by their nature if you've been sort of winning a game, or even... if you're losing at home, I think it's easy to get into the mindset of, fuck it, I don't even want a draw. I don't even care about a draw. It's a rubbish result anyway. But then at the end of the season, you add up two or three of those games where you did scrape draws, and they do really add up, and they are really important. Like, they're often not quite as bad draws as they feel.
You look back at that late equaliser at the London Stadium, and really what turned out to be a pivotal point in Aston Villa's ultimate success. It could be.
The sort of logic that football fans go through, Dave, if you see your team in the league table and you see they've got quite a few draws, your mind immediately goes, well, turn two or three of those into wins, like it could have just happened, and that's it. And then you suddenly look at the match and you go, we could be fourth, we could be third. Absolute nonsense. But interesting here that now two podcasts have try to get to the bottom of this. One biased one, one rather neutral one, that's fine. But the true arbitrator of this, Charlie, would should have been Unai Emery. He should have been asked this. Unai, does it feel like a 0.1 or 0.2 dropped? And that's it. That's the final judgment of this, as far as I'm concerned. But we don't know. We don't have any record of him being asked this, so we'll never, ever know. Right, final item on the adjudication panel came from HP Stats. This is excellent. He says, why is Alan Shearer's name first in Shearer and Sheringham, but second in Sutton and Shearer? Note that switching the names in either of those sounds wrong. Others where the order is important include Heskey and Owen, Raoul and Morientes. The order doesn't seem to matter for Bergkamp, Henri, Phillips and Quinn, Rebroff and Shevchenko. I have a slight preference for York and Cole, but that doesn't sound dreadful the other way round. All my examples are from a similar era, which says something about the death of old-fashioned strike partnerships, but that's for another show. Where, how do we feel about this one, then?
I disagree on the last one. I think York and Cole... Cole and York doesn't sound right. I think it is York and Cole.
I also think it's not Phillips and Quinn, is it? It's definitely Quinn and Phillips. So this does hint, Dave, towards big man, small man dynamic. Whoever's the designated big man comes first.
But yeah, I suppose Shearer is in style, if not in necessarily in height, is the big man in the Shearer and Sheringham situation. Sutton and Shearer... suppose the other way around. I suppose Sutton is obviously not as good a player as Shearer, so kind of gets... is he the big man?
I'm not convinced that this is the logic we should be going for, Charlie.
I think it sounds better. It's rhythmic. It's like married couples. For whatever reason, just some sound way better. Like, what are your parents called, Adam?
What a credible example to use. Chris and Kate. But I mean, I feel this is patriarchy. Though
no, but mine are Carol and William, and would always it would sound it would sound really weird the other way around for whatever reason, and I can't explain because there's not a pattern. You just know. Or what about your set? Are you Adam and Lucinda, or Lucinda and Adam?
Adam and Luce. It depends. It depends whose friends we're talking about. It's interchangeable.
Yes, that's obviously an.
We're York and Cole. We're basically York and Cole.
But there are. I don't know why. It's really hard to explain. I think it's mainly rhythmic rather than anything. I mean, Bergkamp and Henri. One played deeper than the other. So I guess you could make the argument, does the 10 come first before the 9?
Rebrov
and Shevchenko is maybe a bit like that.
Yeah, Dave, so where there isn't an obvious big man, I think the link man should come first. If we were to standardise this and ignore the rhythm of it, I do think the link man should come first. So Sheringham and Shearer should actually be the way round for me. Sutton and Shearer, I guess... just about works. Heskey and Owen works. Bergkamp and Henri is the way round, and that does work. Quinn and Phillips. And then York and Cole, I don't know.
York was, I would say, more of a natural dropping in than Cole was. Cole was more of
he's the finisher.
A penalty box striker. Yeah,
for sure.
So York and Cole.
What about Rooney, Ronaldo, Tevez?
Can't bring in three.
No, you can't do a three.
But now are they more... if they're not striker partnerships, you still have like midfield partnerships, don't you? Or centre-back partnerships.
Mm. But that is the right order, isn't it? You wouldn't say Ronaldo, Rooney, Tevez, or Tevez, Rooney, Ronaldo. It's Rooney, Ronaldo, Tevez.
I have no idea. For me, it just goes left to right on the team sheet, in formation. So whoever's on the left goes first, frankly. And then you get into the acronym, the sort of initialisation situation of MSM, which, and that,
BBC.
I fear that might
BBC.
Dictate it. Yeah, that's annoying. That shouldn't dictate it. That's an annoying development. Anyway, interesting discussion this. And I love this sort of stuff where it becomes a real coin toss, but a logical coin toss, Charlie, where there's some real thinking behind it. This isn't just chance. There's some thinking behind this. There's some learned behaviour, some subconscious patterns behind this. Anyway, speaking of iconic partnerships, it's time for Gray and Key's Corner. Glenn Avery and many others, Charlie, pointing out that this is the one we've all been waiting for. Richard Keys versus Erik ten Hag in the FA Cup semi-final. It's written in the stars. Even regardless of the score, if you take that day in totality, broadcast-wise, this could be Keys at his just... I don't want to say smug. I want to say his little face. Like a little smiley his big face will be, but his little mouth.
Yeah, do you think he'll try really hard, though, to be professional about it? Or will you think he'll just go in for him?
And rightly so, because Coventry are the outliers in this semi-final lineup, Dave. And whilst he doesn't play too much into the whole Coventry thing, I think he'll let loose this time. And he'll lay his cards on the table and say, look, I'm a Coventry guy and that's it. And he'll go for it. And it won't necessarily be at Manchester United's expense. It would just, you know, it's plucky little Coventry in this context. So he'll just play it up. I think it's allowed.
That was a superb Keyes laugh, by the way.
The chances are that United are just going to run out routine winners. He's going to have to work quite hard to find something to have a dig at Ten Hag about.
Could it be in a sort of like, you know, and he's celebrating
could be
this
celebration
win.
Police could be,
you know,
yeah.
They've beaten Coventry, they're eighth in the championship 3-0, and he's celebrating it like they've just beaten Real Madrid. Could be the way in.
As if this needed any more narrative layers, Charlie. There's Mark Robbins in charge of Coventry City. I mean, this helps everybody. This helps montage makers. This helps preview feature writers. But it certainly helps Keyesy. I mean, this is like the solar eclipse of Richard Keyes.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the man who Keyesy wanted or suggested should be getting the United job 2 years ago.
Yeah.
When Ten Toast got it. Mm. And now he has the chance to show him up. You know, think of like the budgets that are going to be cited if and when Coventry run United even remotely close. Like, I mean, look, this team cost a fraction of what Anthony cost. You know, it's just going to be amazing.
And then, of course, you throw in the added layer of Mark Robbins being the guy who scored that goal that saved Alex Ferguson's Manchester United reign and Erik ten Hag being on the brink as far as Keyesy's concerned. I did a bit of reverse engineering of the Erik ten games thing, Charlie. And he dubbed Erik ten Hag Erik ten games just after the defeat to Manchester City in the derby. Now, allowing for some rescheduling of some league games, I believe that the Coventry game will be game 7 after that.
Okay.
That's annoying.
Yeah,
we
that
came
would
so
have been
close.
So perfect.
Yeah, yeah, it's a shame. Anyway, really enjoying at the moment the pathetic rhythm of the Keyesy content machine. This is a rare one. This is one where he's talked about it on BeIn, then done it in his blog, and then talks about it on BeIn again. This really is the rinsing of the socks.
Interested to read an article by Gregor Robertson in the Times this week, talking about the nonsense of cutting holes in socks.
Oh, good.
Kyle Walker was one of the first.
Yes, he was.
He went on to make the point quite rightly. Of course, it makes absolutely not a jot of difference.
Of course it doesn't.
When you think about the fact that they sit in compression socks at the end of the game, which bring a firmness to the calf. Mm.
Does Walker still do it? Kyle Walker? I'm not sure.
I think he probably still does, yes, would be my guess.
Yeah.
Gregor also made the point. He quoted me and said that I was right that in Spain they have outlawed it.
Good.
I sent him a message to say, yeah, I know, I'll research that before I mention it. Although Jude Bellingham gets away with it, of course.
Well, of course he does.
Because he plays...
Who does he play for?
For Real Madrid. But it's gone too far. There is no scientific...
No, there's not.
...evidence that it aids...
No medical evidence.
...blood flow to calves.
No medical evidence.
...at all.
Every single thing Andy Gray says there, he does not have a Scooby-Doo. He doesn't know that Kyle Walker was one of the first. He doesn't know there's no medical evidence. He doesn't know. Absolutely amazing. Just a masterclass of saying, yep, nope.
It is the best Andy Gray call and response we've heard for a very long time. Dave.
That is amazing. Also, to people listening and might not be aware, imagining when on the broadcast that was happening, this very, very, very peripheral topic, that's as the teams are coming out for the FA Cup quarterfinal between City and Newcastle. Like the prime point as we're about to kick off the game, and that's what they're talking
about.
And
it's a good point you make, because they ask themselves whether Kyle Walker is still doing it as Kyle Walker is walking across the screen leading Manchester City out. And you can kind of see, I think the doubt hit them. They go, oh God, God, he's so and his socks are normal. He hasn't got the holes in them. And they have to sort of confront it live.
Just, oh God, it's wonderful. The weirdly somber tone, the hushed tones that he was talking about at the start. He loves, as a journalist, Charlie, he loves sort of citing articles by certain writers.
Yeah. Like,
Gregor Robertson is now going to be his go-to guy, by the way. Once you've been cited once by Keyesy, you get into his inner circle of people that he will offer. So that's it. And next time he cites Gregor Robertson, always enjoy Gregor Robertson's stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Bang on the money from Gregor Robertson again.
And rightly so, good guy. But the little bit he dropped in towards the end, Charlie, so I dropped him a message, and yes, I've done my research before I said that. What a weirdly thing, just That was completely unnecessary. That was a completely unnecessary thing to drop in. So I think in summary then, we've got some absolutely grade A keys coming at the business end of this season. It's all set up for the big man, isn't it? Right. Well, thanks to you, Charlie Eccleshare.
Thank you.
Thanks to you, Dave Walker.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for listening. We're going to be back on Thursday with March's Listeners Mesut Haaland Dicks. See you then.